Okay, so the idea that the working class is too bought off to make a revolution was perhaps most vividly illustrated in George Orwell's 1984. Winston, Orwell's main character, a pen-pushing bureaucrat under the all-seeing, all-knowing Big Brother, understands that the only hope for a different kind of society lay in the proles, the working class. They needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse shaking off flies, he says. But, Winston despairs, films, football, beer, and above all gambling filled up the horizons of their minds. The proles could make a revolution, but until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And until they have rebelled, they can never become conscious. Winston's beliefs about the impossibility of the proles breaking out of their petty concerns can seem a pretty convincing idea. However, Winston, whose job it was to destroy historical documents, did not have the benefit that we do of being able to draw on the long and rich history of working class struggle in order to contradict this idea. And plus, Winston's a fictional character, and you can't believe everything that they tell you. So one of the advantages that we have over Winston, as well as, you know, being real, is that we have the benefit of being able to study the ebbs and flows of history. And one of the things that we see from this study is that often when it's least expected, those walls that have been damming off all the anger and discontent that the working class feels can sometimes break open and the working class fights back. Sometimes it happens when you least expect it. Amongst oil workers in Orinoco, Venezuela, textile workers in central China, young workers in Paris, school teachers in Mexico, or even sitcom writers in Hollywood. Sometimes the working class starts to move. And as these examples reveal, far from being bought off, the working class in the Western world or anywhere else on this planet can never have its needs and wants satisfied by the system of capitalism. And it's precisely because of this failure of the system to provide in periods of economic boom, let alone economic downturn, which has the potential to prompt radical and indeed revolutionary action by the working class. Years ago, in 1968, the working class of France gave an indication of what such a movement could look like. On May the 13th, 10 million people stopped work. 1 million people took to the streets of Paris against their government. The following day, these 10 million people were meant to return to work. However, the dam had broken. Instead, over the course of the next few days, the discontent grew, whilst at the same time, the power of example showed one group after another that they too could strike. The incredible energy of the movement meant that even footballers and ballet dancers went out on strike. Where Winston thought that sport dulled the mind, this lot thought that football should be for the footballers. In the greatest general strike ever seen up to that point, 10 million workers refused to work for the profits of their bosses for a full month. These 10 million workers were shaking the very foundation of society. Now, just 2 years earlier, in 1966, Paul Sweezy, who was an influential Marxist and the editor of Monthly Review, wrote a book called Monopoly Capital. Now, in this book, he argued that industrial workers have, to a large extent, become integrated into the system as consumers and ideologically conditioned members of the society. Now, there's a few theories that have been espoused throughout history which have made their founders look, you know, a little bit foolish. The Atkins diet springs to mind. But really, if you're a Marxist claiming just 2 years before the incredible radical movements of 1968 that the working class was too bought off to be involved in radical action, you'd be feeling pretty foolish. But Sweezy is by no means the only person to have ever made such a mistaken prediction. Indeed, there are entire branches of sociology dedicated to proving that the Western working class has been co-opted into consumer society, and therefore the working class has no compelling reason to turn against capitalism. On the contrary, the reality is that it's the very nature of the capitalist system, the very driving forces inherent in the system, which inevitably impel workers to take a stand against capitalism. So in order to appreciate this, the starting point has to be an understanding of the class relations under capitalism. Now, clearly there are haves and have-nots in this world. People have probably heard the statistic that at least a third of the world's population live on less than US $2 a day. Now, meanwhile, anyone who just happens to have a spare US $16,000 on them can, you know, jet off on your private jet, presumably, off to Tokyo, where you can go to the Ritz-Carlton in Tokyo and buy yourself a $16,000 Diamonds Are Forever martini. Now, this quite extraordinary drink is, you know, made of the finest gin, the finest vermouth, and comes complete with a Bulgari diamond in the bottom of the glass. Clearly, there are differences in the haves and have-nots under this society. Now, as our hero Winston described classes in 1984, the point is, these capitalists, they and a few lawyers and priests and so forth who lived on them, were the lords of the earth. Everything existed for their benefit. You, the ordinary people, the workers, were their slaves. Now, the reason why this wage-slave relationship exists is that the ruling class owns or controls everything that's required for production. The factories, robots, computers, call centres, offices, so forth. The things that Marxists often refer to as the means of production. Meanwhile, the members of the working class own only our own ability to work and produce. So a worker's labour generates wealth, of which the worker herself only keeps a tiny amount in the form of wages. The rest is kept by the boss as profits. Capitalists are able to live off their profits, live off the profits that workers create. They use some of their profits to expand their ability to exploit more workers and thus generate more wealth. Now, the fulcrum on which this relationship rests is exploitation. Exploitation, in the economic sense, is the appropriation of part of the productive labour. In this case, what's being appropriated is the profit created by the working class. Under capitalism, a big part of class boils down to whether you create profits for another person or whether you control the wealth being created by another. In other words, whether you're exploited by another or whether you're doing the exploiting. Now, the fact that exploitation defines the relationship between the working class and the ruling class actually has some pretty major implications. The ruling class is constantly trying to increase the rate of exploitation. To get more profits, bosses try to roll back the wages, conditions, and workplace influence of their workers. If they don't keep their costs down and increase their profits, they'll go under. Now, to illustrate this point, think about the recent Hollywood writers' strike. The reason why the writers were striking was to get paid when their work is streamed over the internet or other new forms of media. Now, of course, the bosses weren't having a bar of this. As one of the writers involved in the strike said, when it came to the revenues from new media, the big producing companies know that's going to be the source of their revenues, because you can tell that they're already trying to circle the wagons and lay claim to all of it. So the gap between how much value the writers were creating and how much they got in return, in other words, the rate of exploitation, was being increased. And this increase in the rate of exploitation is by no means limited to the razzle-dazzle and bright lights of Hollywood. In order for companies to be competitive, they need to constantly be increasing the rate of return on their investments. there's never any time that capitalists can just, you know, sit back on their luxury yachts and go, right, that's it, I've had enough, no more profits for me, thanks. This year's Forbes Rich List, the ranking of the richest people in the world, just came out a couple of weeks ago. Warren Buffett, who's now the world's richest person, is $10 billion richer than he was last year. Bill Gates, who unhappily for him is only the world's second richest person, has increased his wealth by a mere $2 billion. So under capitalism, the key driving force is always accumulation for the sake of accumulation. The system never rests. Now, the effect of this is that the ruling class are constantly trying to increase the rate of exploitation. And throughout the past 35 years, since 1973, the year which marked the end of the long post-war boom, there have been ongoing attacks on the working class's wages and conditions. The end of the boom has seen a declining rate of profit throughout the world and therefore an intensification of attempts to increase the rate of exploitation. In both Australia and internationally, these attacks have been happening. In Australia, there have been an increase in both the number of casual and part-time jobs, as well as an increase in the number of hours worked overall. In the 1960s, around 90% of all jobs were full-time permanent jobs. By 2001, this figure had dropped to only 61%. At the same time, the percentage of people working more than 50 hours a week is up to 21%. Now, in the same period, there's also been a redistribution of wealth from the wages of workers to the profits of bosses. In 1975, the proportion of national income going towards wages was 62%. By 2000, this had dropped to 54%. In the same period, the share of national income going to profits rose from 16% to 24%. In other words, the share of wealth being created, which is going to the boss rather than the worker, is increasing exponentially. But these attempts to increase the rate of exploitation have a few limitations. The most important of these limitations is the resistance of the working class. When these attacks on the working class's wages and conditions become unacceptable to them, they will respond. Farrell Dobbs, who was a socialist and one of the organisers of a general strike in Minneapolis in 1934, put the problem as he encountered it quite lyrically, I think. I love the language that he uses in this quote. Not least of all because he uses the term wiseacres. Who's ever even heard of that term? So, wiseacres of the day spoke pontifically about the passivity of the working class, never understanding that the seeming docility of the workers at a given time is a relative thing. If workers are more or less holding their own in daily life and expecting that they can get ahead slowly, they won't tend to radicalise. Things are different when they're losing ground and the future looks precarious to them. Then a change begins to occur in their attitude, which is not always immediately apparent. The tinder of discontent begins to pile up. Any spark can light it, and once lit, the fire can spread rapidly. Now, the important point here is that it's the gap between the expectations of the working class and the lived reality of the situation that class finds itself in that lights this tinder. Now, a brief caveat, though, is that there's no universal formula for this. You can't say after an X percent wage cut or a Y percent increase in the rate of exploitation, there'll be a strike. There are various mediating factors, such as the history of victories and defeats of the working class, or the political situation of the day, or the confidence and relative strength of the ruling class. However, the crucial point is that the combativity of the working class is spurred by the increasing gulf between the lived reality of the situation of the working class and their expectations. Indeed, this gulf can be widened either by the reality of the situation being degraded, such as the Hollywood writers' experience of the increased rate of exploitation, or it can be widened by the expectations of the working class being raised. So this brings us to a pretty common question that I'm sure many people here have thought themselves. So isn't it the case that the workers need to feel that they've got nothing left to lose in order to fight back? In fact, none of these things are set in stone. When people feel like they've got nothing left to lose, sometimes they can feel that they've got nothing to win either. The decisive factor is not the degradation of living standards per se, but rather the increased gap between lived standards and expectations. So to illustrate the point, I spoke before about the experience of the French general strike of 1968. The underlying causes of the radical movement was not an absolute degradation. The Parisian workers were certainly not living in squalor. Indeed, the British Economist published a survey that they'd conducted before the event. They published this survey in May 1968, which claimed that French living standards had actually overtaken those in Britain. And yet, those dynamics of capitalism, which constantly push for a greater and greater rate of exploitation, were still at play. De Gaulle, the French president, had come to power in 1958. In the 10 years to 1968, he'd increased the competitiveness of French industry. During these 10 years, the rate of exploitation of French capitalism had been raised by more than a third to 26% of gross national product. So on the one hand, even in the midst of this economic boom, the working class was still being attacked. The reality of their situation was still being degraded. On the other hand, the expectations of the working class were raised by the idea that you could win not just better paying conditions, but that you could win the right to your own humanity. University students in France inspired the revolt of the workers by showing that you could effectively change the system. Well, challenge the system, rather. The students' revolt was because of the oppressive nature of the system, as well as the failures of the universities in the country. The workers' strike were not just about better pay. They were against the authoritarian rule of De Gaulle. They were against alienation. They were against the whole dehumanising factory system. They were against the international situation of the war in Vietnam, and they were for sexual liberation. One leader of one of the French trade unions posed this raised expectation of the workers like this. He said, "I did not believe in a worker ending to the student agitation, but it was logical. Put yourself in the shoes of our lads. In a few days, they learnt many things. First of all, that action pays. No one used to talk about the situation of the university. Now everyone does. All the barriers the government had erected against strikes had been broken. The government was incapable of making people respect its laws. The result," he continued, "was workers discovered that it was possible to fight, and that when you fight well, not only is there a chance of winning, but the risks involved were quite small. From that to action to resolve old problems was only a small step." However, in the rebellion of Paris 68, the ruling class still had a few tricks up its sleeve. One of the keys to any successful revolution is that the old ruling class must be incapable of continuing their rule. In periods of deep societal crisis, the general hostility of the mass of the working class towards the ruling class becomes so great that the normal competition between members of the ruling class becomes outright hatred. Sections of the state turn against each other. Divisions develop at the top of society about how to restore order. One section argues to crush the movement in blood. Another argues to grant reforms in order to placate the movement. A third section argues for a combination of the two. If reforms are granted, the movement can be emboldened by its success and draw in other sections of society. If repression is used, the outrage of that of that, against that repression can draw in other sections of society. Society balances on a knife's edge. Will the old order reimpose itself, or will new social forces seize power? This is the essence of a revolutionary situation. But if those leading the movement are able to channel the struggle into reforms that do not fundamentally challenge the status quo, then it's possible that the movement can be diffused before it reaches revolutionary proportions. In the absence of a mass revolutionary socialist party arguing against accepting the measly concessions of the reformists in Paris 68, this is precisely what happened. And because the movement was diffused in this way, the movement subsided and the old order was able to reimpose itself. But despite this failure to grasp the potential and challenge the very nature of the capitalist system, the mass radical action of May 68 is an inspirational example of the ability of workers to fight back. And this example is certainly not the only one of relatively affluent workers taking radical action. Indeed, it's precisely because of the numerous examples of such action that Orwell's Big Brother in 1984 needed to destroy the remnants of the past. Big Brother's slogan of ignorance is strength is actually true in one sense. Our ignorance of such historical examples is strength to the ruling class that wants to stop us from ever challenging their rule again. Now, before moving on, just wanted to summarise the points that I've made so far. Firstly, the overwhelming dynamic of the system of capitalism is a push towards greater rate of exploitation at the expense of workers. Secondly, this dynamic degrades the material realities of the situation of the working class. Thirdly, the impetus for radical action comes from the increasing irreconcilability of the material reality of the situation of the working class and the expectations of that class. Now, I'm sure that there are some of you out there who are thinking, well, that's all well and good, but what does all this mean for today? And I think that's a very good question. After all, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And what is it that we see in the present? In Australia today, mortgage rates are rising 2.5 times faster than household incomes. 1.1 million Australians are paying more than a third of their income towards their mortgages. 35% of over 65s don't have any superannuation savings, and those that do are seeing them rapidly being squeezed because of the current economic instability. It's predicted that petrol will soon reach $3.10 per litre. The price of food, rent, water, electricity, etc., etc., all of these things are rising. And it's the residents of the McMansions in Keilor, which I'll remind everyone, are both cheaper to buy than inner city housing, but also that they're cheaper to build than smaller housing in these same suburbs because of the scrupulousness of the like massive multinational corporations that build these McMansion kind of enclaves, who use shoddy materials and cut corners this way and that in order to create these houses, this mass-produced housing. It's precisely the residents of these McMansions in Keilor who are feeling the effects of this squeeze. And it's even worse in America, where the subprime crisis has begun to be felt by the 2 million people who are expected to lose their homes this year. In other words, it's massively overstated just how bought off the working class actually is. And indeed, according to some economists, the future looks bleak. London's Financial Times, by no means a socialist newspaper, argued that the worst of the subprime crisis will see primordial fear slowly setting in as everyone still believes in the Goldilocks-Reed Pollyanna future. Millions of Americans will undergo cutbacks in salary, others will lose jobs. People will learn to work with their hands again, class and racial struggles will erupt with greater intensity. So, far from capitalism being a stable system immunised against severe crisis, the system looks set to continue on its routine downturn, much to the misfortune of the working class. And as the old saying goes, when the US economy sneezes, the world catches a cold. We live in an integrated world economy. Therefore, the effects of the US subprime crisis will be felt around the world. And although it's clear that these factors have not affected the Australian working class to the extent to prompt revolutionary action on a mass scale, we can see indications that radical action is not completely out of the question by looking in a few different directions. So firstly, the fact that over the past 10 years, some of the largest political demonstrations in Australia's history have taken place. 1 million people across Australia marching against the war on the Valentine's Day weekend in 2003. 500,000 across Australia against Howard's work choices in November 2005. 250,000 people in Sydney alone walking across the Sydney Harbour Bridge for Aboriginal rights in 2000. But there are also some really significant social attitude surveys which indicate that the Australian working class is not as irredeemably right-wing and pro-capitalist as many believe. For example, in 2003, a social attitude survey conducted by one of the departments at the Australian National University found that 59.6% of people thought big business had too much power. 84% believed income differences in Australia are too large. 2/3 believed that working people do not get a fair share of the nation's wealth. And additionally, we've seen survey after survey which indicate anti-sexist, anti-racist and anti-homophobic attitudes. But the question is then begged, how can such sentiment be translated into revolutionary action? In other words, how do people's ideas change? Once again, we need to go back to the very dynamics of the capitalist system. The necessity of the ruling class to attack the wages and conditions of the working class pushes workers to fight back. By placing the working class in this bind, the ruling class runs the risk of sparking struggles that can contradict the very ideas workers have previously accepted. Ideas of obedience and individualism, for example, are undermined when workers go on strike. Instead, they're replaced by notions of resistance, solidarity, class consciousness. Revolutionary movements can take off very rapidly once they begin, for the very simple reason that one of the key things holding people back is the idea that no one else feels as they do. Where Winston thought that until the proles become conscious, they will never rebel, and until they've rebelled, they can never become conscious, what we can see is that the consciousness that the proles need to rebel comes from the experience of capitalism, and the consciousness that they attain comes from the experience of rebelling. So to conclude, the ruling class is constantly impelled by the dynamics of the system to attack workers' rights and conditions. This, in turn, drives the working class to defend their interests, which forces a reassessment of the common sense ideas about the nature of the system that we've been taught from birth. Indeed, ideas are by no means unimportant. One of the strongest tools that the ruling class has against us is their ideological hegemony. No system that's based on the exploitation of the overwhelming majority by a tiny minority can maintain itself when it's such an unequal and exploitative relationship. This cannot be maintained without a degree of coercion. And so the working class needs to be taught to submit to this unequal relationship. We're taught to doubt ourselves and accept the system of capitalism. We're taught to doubt our ability to stand up and fight for our rights. We're taught to doubt our ability to run society. And most importantly, we're taught to doubt that there's any alternative to this system. So why bother trying to create a better world? You'd be the only one who wanted it anyhow. But this doubt is not eternal. The doubt can dissolve when, in the process of struggle, this ideological hegemony is challenged. And then we can see what Bertolt Brecht described as the most beautiful of all doubts in his poem In Praise of Doubt. He said, "The most beautiful of all doubts is when the downtrodden and despondent raise their heads and stop believing in the power of their oppressors." Thank you.